Welcome to Happily Ever After is just the beginning. Keeping your relationship not just together, but happy, and we mean truly happy, is part art and part science. You've come to the right place. Here's your host, Leslie Dorries.
Welcome to another episode of Happily Ever After is just the beginning. This is Leslie Dorries. And luckily for me, many things that I do really amuse my husband, but in a good way. One of those things is my nearly constant habit of people watching. At restaurants, at shopping malls, and especially at airports, I'm guilty of watching how people interact. And to be honest, sometimes I'm close enough to overhear their conversations. And okay, maybe that's just a little bit creepy, but I like to think of it as a hazard of the job. I call it a hazard because a lot of what I see and hear is really depressing. Couples who are frustrated or angry with each other, or worse, couples who seem completely disconnected. I realize that I'm only getting a snapshot of a moment of their lives together, and I truly, truly hope that that moment is an anomaly for them. But unfortunately, based on what my clients bring to me, I know it is often their norm. I frequently fight the temptation to hand out my business card en masse. What I know is that couples really don't have to settle for these less than relationships. There are lots of ways to make them better, but very few couples actually take advantage of those opportunities. And frankly, this has always been a mystery to me. People take their cars in for regular maintenance, get their oil changed, they do their termite inspections on their homes and fix their roofs. They go to the doctor when they're sick, but they let their marriages stagnate. And one of the most important relationships of their lives is ignored until no amount of CPR can bring it back to life. But one person who decided to buck that norm of either accepting the relationship as it is or ending it, took action to improve her marriage, is my guest today, Elisa Bowman. She is a journalist who writes for Reader's Digest, Prevention, and Parents magazines. She's co-authored several books, and she also runs the blog Project Happily Ever After, which is a continuation of her book of the same name. Elisa, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So one of the reasons several years ago I was, running around the internet and looking at all kinds of things, and your Project Happily Ever After blog was, I think, listed as one of the 10 best marriage blogs. I can't remember where I saw that, and I thought that was great. And so I started reading you and following you, and I love the subtitle of the blog, because life after I do isn't always so charming. And so, where did you get, obviously, since I named the show Happily Ever After, it's just the beginning, I think we're somewhat on the same wavelength, but what prompted you to use that title, and what exactly was going on in your life that started all this for you?
Sure. I mean, that title mostly grew out of the fact that we really, as a society and as a culture, focus on the marriage, the wedding, the moment that you say I do. There's so much about dating, and all of our fairy tales are about the falling in love. We never see a fairy tale that even goes beyond that moment of when, the two main characters realize that they're made for each other, and they kiss and they ride a horse off into the sunset.
Right, and they live happily ever after.
Yes, and you just assume, they found each other, they were right for each other, and they never had a fight. And so when you're married, and, maybe it doesn't happen the day after your wedding, but it definitely happens at some point where you start arguing and other issues crop up, whether it's issues in the bedroom or a lack of romance or just this general feeling that your relationship isn't as close as you think it should be. You start to really judge yourself and think, well, I'm the only one that's going through this. Everybody else found the right mate, and maybe there's something wrong with me, or we automatically go to the, I married the wrong person. So,
or it's my partner who's doing something.
Yeah, and my partner's faulty, and I picked the wrong partner, and we automatically start thinking about divorce. Like, we don't realize there's something in between that, you know, what's going on in that extreme of divorce.
Right.
And, you know, and this happened to me. You know, I fell in love with the man who's now my husband, and we got married, and things were good for a while, but, you know, we weren't putting energy into being happily married. I suffered from this belief that, well, being happily married is something that just happens if you married the right person. And so we became parents and took on some stressors. He started a business. And our relationship really, really suffered. And to the point where, you know, we couldn't even, there was no romance because we'd run out of things to say to each other. You know, the bedroom life was almost non-existent. And most of our conversations were stressful. Like, they were about arguments over time, arguments over energy.
Right.
And I was really thinking, well, you know, this is it. I married the wrong person. But then, you know, I had a really good friend who encouraged me. She says, you know, there's something you can try before divorce, and it's called counseling.
Well, yeah, I mean, but unfortunately, being a therapist, and especially where I am, that's a four-letter word.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, now I joke because I was born and raised in Los Angeles, and everybody has, you know, a therapist or two or three.
Yeah.
You know, but for a lot of people, they look at that as a failure, and I'm hearing from you that there was a part of that, you know, in your mind that was like, well, I must be, you know, I must have failed somehow, without recognizing that, yeah, no, this is completely normal, which is a little bit scary to even think about.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think in the beginning, I didn't have a perception exactly that there was something wrong with me. What I really thought was I married the wrong person.
Right.
Like, I went straight there, and I thought, well, if I can't fix him, then that's it. Like, I really had this I have to fix my husband mentality. And,
right.
you know, there are books
Which
by that
title. Which we all know
title,
how well
so
that
I don't think
doesn't
I'm the,
work.
Yeah. I don't think I'm the only person who's had that belief. But then over time, as we worked on things, I did see what my part of the problem was. And the other thing that really hit home was that what we need to be happily married are all of these skills that we don't learn in school and that people don't necessarily teach us unless we're seeking them out. And they're things like assertiveness and problem solving and how to apologize and how to accept an apology and move on. And how to forgive, things like that. And we, you know, these are things that we think are ideal, but, you know, we kind of think, well, I was born that way. I'm either assertive or I'm not. And a lot of times we don't understand that we can actually learn how to be assertive.
Well, and people don't, and there are a lot of people that misunderstand, because I see this a lot, especially with the wife half of the couple. Now, on occasion, sometimes I'll end up with men who don't understand. Well, I guess they're assertive in a different way, but assertive doesn't necessarily have to be, well, in fact, it never is bad. Now, how, you know, if we're aggressive, that's one thing. If we're assertive, that's something else. And one of the things that I always tell my clients is your voice matters. This is an equal relationship, and your voice is as important as your partner's. But a lot of times, women are taught, "Well, no, no, no. I have to be quiet and just accept this."
Exactly. I mean, there's definitely a middle way between being a resentful doormat and being loud and aggressive. And when you learn how to ask for what you need, I mean, in the beginning, I think it's a little rough because you're learning this skill, and sometimes you swing to either extreme, but it's something that you're practicing. And over time, as you get better at it, you learn how to make requests with, you know, a warm tone of voice and to not over-request, you know, and to not take a half hour, you know, to ask for what you want. You get it down to just a couple sentences.
Right.
And to understand that, you know, sometimes my request will be met with a no. Sometimes it'll be met with a maybe or a yes. But to know that any of those outcomes are really okay because you have this trust that your relationship is a good foundation. That
mentioned that T word. Well, because isn't that part of what happens is that we stop trusting. We stop trusting our partner, and then on some level we stop trusting in ourselves. Like you stopped trusting in the idea that your husband was actually a good fit for you.
Right. Yeah. And I think there's other trust that has to build over time if you don't have it. It's not like you can just change your mind and start trusting. But there's other ways. Like I think when we're afraid to be assertive, one of the things that we're afraid of is that we're going to be rejected. And I don't mean rejected with a no, but we think, well, if I ask for what I want, my husband will stop loving me, or he'll think his view of me will go down, or something like that. And that's, I mean, unless you're in an abusive relationship, which is a whole other ball of wax,
right.
I really don't think that's true. If anything, when I talk to men, what they tell me is, I really just want to know what my wife wants. I'm sick of guessing.
Right.
you know?
I mean, but then there's that wonderful, well, if my partner really loved me, they would just know what I want.
Exactly.
I love my mother to death. And she and I were actually visiting my sister. We were actually on a hike, and thank goodness I was behind her when we were hiking, because I swear to God, what she said to me was, women shouldn't have to ask for what they want. And if she had turned around, she would have seen my jaw on the ground, like going, oh, my God, how's that working for you, Mom? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But this is part of the happily ever after concept, you know, and I use that term because I actually believe that happily ever after doesn't have to be a myth, but we actually have to discuss what that happily means,
right?
And how to attain it, and it's not like some, you know, Cinderella's fairy godmother who comes around and sprinkles pixie dust on you and go, okay, you're happy now. Nothing bad is ever going to happen. No challenge is ever going to come up.
Right. I think, you know, it's interesting this expectation that our spouse will always know what we want. And, you know, and I had that for a really long time. And I think that comes probably from watching soap operas and romantic comedies. And I'm not really sure why that expectation's out there, because if you really think about it in a rational way, it doesn't make any sense. Like you wouldn't go to a restaurant and expect the waitress or waiter to know what you want without actually telling them.
Right.
And like we don't do this in really any other area of our lives. We don't expect people to just guess what we want, but we seem to expect it from our spouses. And, you know, there's lots and lots of research that shows that we really, as human beings, have a really hard time reading other human beings' minds, and we're almost always wrong. You know,
well,
we're reading all these intentions into others that aren't there, and we think people are mad at us when they're not, and, you know, we think someone's being flirtatious when they're not, and, you know, like, we're often wrong. So the only way that your spouse is really going to know is if you tell him. And I think a better definition of love would be how your spouse responds to that request, not the fact that you actually have to make it, but, you know, what happens after you make it. Does he try to change? Does he listen? Does he take it into account and say, well, I would like to do that, but here's what my problem is with doing that, and do end up having a conversation and grow closer? That's a better definition of love, I think, than this expectation that our spouses will read our minds.
Well, yeah, and then that kind of throws in something else that I get sometimes is, well, my partner is only doing it because I asked them to. And there's a part of me that goes, and the problem with that is what? Because they could always choose not to.
Exactly.
And, you know, the kind of flip retort I give back is, well, when they give you the Christmas present that you asked for, do you return it?
Yeah, right.
And they look at me like, it's exactly the same thing. You've asked for something. It registered. They're trying to do it.
Yes.
And then here's the question. How do we set them up to succeed for that?
Right, exactly. And I think we need to acknowledge that they're putting an effort rather than, you know, pinning it on getting a certain gift that's a surprise. Think, well, you know, my spouse still asked. He still thought about it. He still went to the store. Maybe he compared prices. He waited online. I mean, I don't know. Some people love shopping. I really don't like it. So if my husband goes out and gets me the next cell phone and talks to the person and figures out the right one and all of that, I'm just happy I didn't have to do it myself. So that's like the biggest gift, you know, anybody
right.
can give me, is like to go out and get the right thing and make sure it's the right size or whatever. So I think, like, if we acknowledge that, okay, maybe our spouse doesn't have the ability to read our mind, but they still are putting in all this effort to give us what we want. And that I don't know any better indication of love than that.
And I love that definition, because it is about action. I mean, you know, people forget that love is a verb. It's like
right.
is somebody making the effort, and here's, you know, and can we give them credit for trying, even if maybe they're off base?
Right.
But can we give them, you know, can we give them the effort for trying? Because I think that's one of the things, and you know, I try to stay too much away from gender differences except for when they're real.
Yeah.
And none of us like to feel like we're failing, and I think that's especially true for mm-hmm. men, that yeah. men would rather do nothing than risk failing.
Yeah.
So then here they're supposed to be figuring out this stuff. Maybe they've tried a few things that they think might work, but the reaction they get back isn't great. They go, okay, not going to try that again.
Exactly. You know, the other thing is we all, whatever our gender is, we have a negativity bias that encourage, you know, we tend to see the negative. And it's something that we really need to keep in check in our relationships, because what will happen is chances are your spouse is putting in effort and is attempting to change, but you're only going to notice the times when your spouse doesn't do it. And so
right.
as an example, let's say your spouse is a messy person and you've asked your spouse to wash or just put the dishes in the dishwasher when he or she's done with them. And what you're going to notice are the times that he or she doesn't do it.
Right.
But, you know, chances are, like, that person is making improvements and is putting them in the dishwasher more often, but isn't exactly at the point of 100% perfection yet. And so if you can, like, train yourself to look for the changes that are moving in the right direction or the direction that you're asking for, you'll see, like, how much effort they're putting in. And so, like, one thing I try to do, not just with my spouse, but even with people in general, is to just look for kindness. I'm like, how is this person being kind today, yesterday, over the past week?
Right.
And if you look for it and really search for it, you will definitely find it, and your life really improves. You start to feel very happy because you're like, wow, look at all these people that are really putting in some energy to make my day go a little more smoothly. But if we don't look for it, we miss it.
Right. And, well, I mean, and I frequently will talk about the power of the negative, which is exactly what you're talking about. So when I work with my clients, what I tell them to aim for is the 85 to 90% of the time for the relationship to be the way you want, because there is no perfect, there is no ideal. And, you know, if we're that way 85 to 90% of the time, the 10 to 15% of the time it's not going the way we want, we've got enough cushion to give on that.
Exactly. Yeah, cuz none of us are perfect.
Oh, no, we're perfect, though. I just wanted to remind my listeners that they're listening to Happily Ever After is Just the Beginning on webtalkradio.net. I'm Leslie Dorries, and we are talking today with journalist Elisa Bowman about the decision she made to make her marriage better and what she's continuing to do to keep it that way. And if you want personal help with your marriage, email me at Leslie, L-E-S-L-I, at foundationscoachingnc.com today. And now back to our conversation. So, Elisa, what was, you know, so you made the decision to really put an all-out effort to get your marriage back on track. And so you said you went to counseling, and sometimes counseling, I mean, I've actually had people come into my office and they've told me about other counselors, and it just makes me cringe. Because like in anything else, there are good ones and bad ones. But what exactly did you, other than going to counseling, which is always a good first step, did you do different?
Sure. I mean, I did a lot of reading. And interestingly, for people who maybe they're afraid to take too big of a step, you know, self-help books about marriage and relationships have a lot of good information in them. And I had a very open mind, probably because I'm a journalist. You know, I'm always like, well, I'll try. I'm often experimenting with things to see if they work, because I don't necessarily write about something if I don't think it'll work for
right.
other people.
But yeah, this isn't going the way I thought it
yeah,
would go.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, I'll try anything, even if I think it's a little dumb, because I'm curious to see how it'll work in my marriage. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there were these different techniques. For instance, the speaker-listener technique, where if somebody wants to say something, for instance, let's say if my husband had a request for change, then I would give him the floor and I would listen. And then I rephrase it to him. I say, well, this is what I heard you say. Is this what you mean? And then he says yes or no, depending on
right.
how far off I was or whether I was right on. And then I respond and he listens to me. And it sounds a little bit mechanical. And I think it is in the beginning. When you're first practicing it, it feels a little mechanical.
Yep.
But after you get used to it, it really does work. All this, because what usually happens in a fight is neither one of you is listening.
Right.
You know, you have this perception that your spouse isn't listening, right? You're like, okay, my spouse is not listening to me, so
right.
I need to talk louder. But what's happening is you're not listening to your spouse either. And so you're both just yelling, and neither one of you is listening, and you're not getting anywhere.
Right. You hear just enough to formulate your counterattack.
Yeah, exactly.
I hear just enough, and then I don't hear the rest of it.
Yes. So, I mean, that worked a lot, really well. You know, and we tried other things like talking in I statements and a lot with communication, because I think that was my big area. I was not
well,
very
a journalist,
assertive.
It would be.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm great at communicating and writing, not so much verbally,
mm-hmm.
although I've come a long way. And I really was one of those people who just wanted my husband to read my mind and do the right things, and I judged him by it. Like, well, if he doesn't do what I want, then he's a bad person. So I had to give that all up and learn how to be assertive. And, you know, there's other advice out there about how to request somebody to change and to say it shorter. So, you know, when I would initially try to be assertive, I would build up this whole argument
uh-huh.
that would start with, well, this is what's wrong, and this is why it's bothering me, and this is why I think you're wrong, and it would go on and on and
right.
on. And I learned how to get it down to just two or three sentences. And I think, you know, it sounds like it initially feels like if you only say a few sentences that it's not convincing enough. But
right.
in reality, it's probably more effective and more convincing, because you're not attacking their character and you're not making them defensive and feeling like they have to stick up for themselves and feeling like you think they're a bad person. You're basically just asking, hey, could you put that dish in the dishwasher? Or, hey, next time
right.
you do this, could you do it this way? Because I'd really appreciate it. Really simple requests are more likely to end up with a good result. And this is true everywhere in life. So it's one
right.
of those things that, you know, it helps you everywhere you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, because number one, it's easy to complain,
yeah.
but it's a little bit harder. It's like, okay, here's your complaint. What is it that you want instead?
Yes.
And if you can phrase what I want instead, the request, number one, it's easier to hear than just a barrage of bad, of negative. And it's like, you know, hey, next time could we just do this instead? And most of the time, people, I mean, you know, unless they have some objection to that, which you know, needs to be talked about, they'll go, sure, why not?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think we overestimate our spouse, the probability of our spouse saying no or digging in or giving us a hard time. And we underestimate the probability of them just being like, oh, yeah, sounds a good idea. Okay, great. Thanks for letting me know. And, you know, you won't, I think people listening probably won't believe that until it happens in their life. But, you know, if you could just keep track, I think you'll see that your spouse is probably more agreeable, especially when, you know, you don't attack their character. I mean, I think that's the big thing. Too often we think we have to start a request for change with an argument and an attack of character, and we really don't.
Well, and that's, and like you said, that almost always sets it up for failure.
Right.
And it's one of the things that, that I try to tell my clients. And in fact, it's actually when they come back to me and they say it is the hardest suggestion that I make to them, is to try to never use the word you in the first three words of a sentence unless it's I love you, you're wonderful, and you're the most wonderful thing that's ever happened in my life. Then you can use you to, but it's like, but you know, but most of the time it starts out, you did this or why did you, and then that's the shot across the bow. And I can't really hear because I've just been attacked.
Right, exactly. And you know, think about what it feels like when you're attacked. Like, that was one of the things I had to, like, constantly put myself in his shoes. Like, oh, I wouldn't like it if he talked to me that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess I can understand why he gets defensive. And it really made things easier for me when I understood it from his perspective. One of the other areas that we really worked on was romance, because, like I said, things were pretty dead in the bedroom. And I felt like, you know, how do I get back into this? Like, how do I fall back in love with my husband? And, you know, there's a lot of advice about having a date night, but that wasn't really working for us because we would go out to eat and we'd just be, like, staring at each other.
Right.
And, you know, like
you'd be one of those couples I'd want to hand my business card to.
Yeah. You know, like, what do we do? And so, but I still, you know, had this idea that dating was a good thing. I just didn't quite understand how to do it.
Right.
And what I ended up doing was thinking, well, what did we used to enjoy? And how can we bring those things back? Because, you know, we had lost a lot of those when we became parents, when he started his business. We just got so busy, and we really were tired. And so some of it I was like, okay, we are tired, and I'm going to let that be, because that's part of parenting a toddler or a baby. You know, you are sleep-deprived and worn out.
Yes.
But we ended up having a weekend away, and it became really fun to plan the weekend away because it was a much bigger production than just going out to dinner. And I knew we'd be sleeping over, and we were not going to have a toddler in tow. And so we really did have more freedom to have fun. And that seemed to really start off a better dating relationship. It became like, this is a beautiful thing. We had this great romantic weekend. And I in my mind, I was like, I tried to see him as if we had just met, and he was this guy that I'm just getting to know all over again, and that really helped.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, and that's a challenge, because every in fact, my last show was about spouse dates, and you know, and it's kind of, you know, and my rule of thumb for having a date with your partner is that fun is the purpose. That, you know, I mean, and a lot of people go out, like you and your husband go out to dinner, and then they stare across the table at each other going, or worse, they dissect the relationship, which is, date night, woo, let's go do that. And, you know, and you guys, it sounds like you guys rediscovered yourselves as individuals and as lovers, as partners, not just as parents, which is, you know, many of us get married and having a family is part of that. But the damage that does to the relationship, I think, is seriously underestimated. And I don't mean that we shouldn't have kids or that we should ignore our children. By all means, no. I mean, I have, you know, I tell people I have adults now. They're both over 18. But, you know, it is a time where we have to be much more intentional. Otherwise, things fall apart. But I wanted to ask you, so you made this, because you talk about it being a four-month effort.
Yes.
And so, you know, and I want my listeners to really hear that it doesn't take forever. So was it really 4 months? And you know, and I mean, obviously everything's not perfect because we've already decided perfect doesn't exist. But what were you able to accomplish in that four-month period?
Well, you know, we actually started having a bedroom life again, and we were having conversations again, and I was able to feel safe asking for what I wanted, knowing that he was going to listen. And, you know, was our relationship perfect at the end of 4 months? No, it wasn't. But at the end of 4 months, I knew that we were going to keep improving. All I had to do was keep leaning on these skills that I was learning, and really all he needed to do was be receptive. It's fascinating that you don't really need two people to be trying to fix the relationship. You know, and my husband is definitely not the kind of person who's going to read a series of self-help books or who's going to really invest himself in marital counseling. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are like that, but he is the kind of person who, if I suggest, well, I want to try something, it's going to improve our relationship, he'll try it. Now, if he thinks it's dumb, he will tell me.
But that's also important to know that not every suggestion needs to be fully embraced. It's like, okay, try this. If it doesn't work, or if you think it sounds ridiculous, we'll move on to something else.
Exactly. And we tried some things that didn't work, and it was good that happened, because it helped me to see, you know, it's okay for things not to work. Like, it doesn't mean that our relationship's going to be destroyed because I tried this thing called the relaxed hug and I felt uncomfortable the whole time and it didn't get us anywhere, you know?
Right.
I was like, okay, that's one thing that didn't work for us. We won't do that again. Okay, fine. And you move on.
So can you tell my listeners, where they can find you? So, because I know that, you know, like I said, I've been reading your blog for a long time, and I think it's got some really, really good advice for people who maybe aren't quite ready or don't have access to more concentrated help, although there's a whole part of me that says, you know, it's like the MasterCard commercials, you know, priceless. It's like, what, you know, what's making your marriage better or worse? But can you tell them how to find you?
Sure. They can go to projecthappilyeverafter.com. And what they want to look for, I have like the most popular articles highlighted on the right hand of the page. And I think most people will find that those most popular articles are the ones that they're looking for. And they'll probably take them to other articles that they want. But really, like the most popular ones I have on there are, you know, my spouse told me that she's not in love with me anymore.
Right.
Or, you know, my spouse is that kind of person who always is always right and never admits being wrong. What do I do? You know, and those have like hundreds of comments on them, and some of them I wrote a few years ago, but they really do seem to resonate with people. So I'd highly suggest that. And, you know, they can always connect with me on Facebook. My Facebook is Elisa Bowman Writes, and, you know, through Facebook they can message me. And I do try to get back to people. Sometimes when I'm on deadline, because I am a journalist, it takes me a few days to respond to some of my emails, but I do try.
Well, and I want to thank you, you know, so much for being with us and sharing. Really, if my listeners take away nothing else from this conversation today, that I want them to know that they don't have to settle for a less-than marriage. And you know, just wishing and hoping it will change isn't going to make it happen.
Right.
and even time and just talking about it won't necessarily make it happen. That, listeners, if you want your marriage to be different, you are going to have to take action. And as Elisa says, your partner doesn't have to join you. You can do it. You can start doing things and implementing things all on your own. And that there's lots of ways to make it better. And I'm going to end with this you know, her, on Elisa's number 11 tip in her manifesto, that a marriage work in progress, you can always do something to make your marriage better. And so to keep learning about ways to improve your marriage, keep tuning in to Happily Ever After is Just the Beginning. And until next time, stay loving.